Morning and welcome. I'm Frank Verastro. I'm director of the Energy and National Security Program here at CSIS. We started a series on smart grid. We actually did a little work on this in the last 2 years, but we thought with all the activity that's going on in the Hill and in the policy debate, it would be a good thing to kind of focus attention on what a smart grid really is and what it is not, because it's come to mean, even though it's part of the energy vernacular these days, it means a lot of different things. It's either all things to all people, or it's infrastructure build-out, or it's interoperability at the consumer side of the quotient, and it looks at technologies and how you manage energy in your home. And in a large part, it's all of these things. But there's a sequence and an investment scale to get this done. You know, it's not just about bringing solar from Kansas to New England. And there's various steps in the process about how that gets done. How you balance systems, how you look at different electrons, if there is a way of looking at electrons, because once it's in the system, you can't distinguish between solar electrons and natural gas electrons. The role of natural gas in a climate or carbon-constrained world, what you do with coal, where 50% of our electricity is derived now, what's the role for nuclear? So we thought, at least to start, we needed to identify some of the myths behind this. Let's talk about what actually smart grid encompasses, what it takes to get there. And so we thought, while it would take a series of sessions to do this right, that the first panel had to be a mix of folks that could give you the broad overview as well as dive down into the details, because there's different levels of understandings in all audiences, and the questions kind of vary. So we didn't want to make it too superficial a session, but in an hour and a half, recognizing that you also can't roll up your sleeves and get into all the nitty-gritty at various levels. So we're going to do this over the course of 2 or 3 sessions. So this is just really the kickoff session. And with that, man, I'd actually like to thank Brendan Harney, who was our staff associate who actually put the session together and did a terrific job in assembling the panel. Recognizing that we could have selected a wide range of visionaries and technology experts, policymakers, investors to do this, that's what we got. We decided on the panelists that you see in front of you that this is a knowledgeable group. We've worked with them before. We just think it's terrific for them to be able to set the stage, and we thank them all for attending as well as for your participation this morning. Their detailed bios are included in the handout materials, so I'll just briefly go through in terms of introduction, what they bring to the table this morning. I've also decided that we're going to kind of flip the series. We had Jeff going first this morning. We're going to start with David to frame up the issues, move to Jeff Wright on FERC to talk about what FERC is doing now and kind of nuts and bolts, and then close with Lawrence. And then what we plan to do is open it up for a question answer. With the approval of the panel, we will provide all of their slide presentations, and we'll post them on our website, so that will all be available to you as well, probably not this afternoon, but maybe tomorrow morning, and we certainly expect this discussion to continue. So starting with David Manning, David currently serves as Executive VP at National Grid, but his resume also includes prior responsibility as Deputy Minister of Energy for the Province of Alberta. He was a delegate to the Kyoto Conference on Climate Change, and Executive VP and Chief Environmental Officer of KeySpan, which was New York State's largest power generator and one of the nation's largest gas distributors. Jeff Wright is the Deputy Director of FERC's Office of Energy Projects, and that's the office responsible for, among other things, processing applications for the construction and operation of interstate natural gas pipelines, storage facilities, and LNG terminals, as well as non-federal hydroelectric projects and dealing with the siting issues surrounding interstate electric transmission lines and their facilities. So we'll cover a broad range of federal state issues as well. Dr. Lawrence Jones of Areva. Lawrence has joined us here for a number of discussions on smart grid and electric power over the years, and he always teaches me something. So no pressure today, Lawrence, but I expect to learn something new today as well. He currently serves as Director for Strategy and Business Development for the Americas. He's got over 18 years experience in various facets of the electric power industry. His area of focus includes smart transmission and distribution grids, renewable energy, climate change impacts of energy systems. These are all relevant topics, as you'll agree. Cell phones. Since we have a big group today, this would be a great time to turn off your cell phones before we get started. I think if it's too hot or too cold in here, we'll adjust the temperature for you. But with that, let's get started. So, David, the podium is yours, and thank you all for coming.
Something's up, obviously, when you have to pull out more chairs for a discussion of a grid. Lawrence, you've been at this longer than I have, but I don't think you've ever seen that before. In any event, one quick anecdote to start. I was in D.C. chatting with several members of Congress about stimulus dollars, and maybe 10 bankers and myself, and this very prominent member of Congress, who will go unnamed, said, you know, National Grid, as soon as he heard my title, National Grid, he said, that's what we need. We need a smart grid because, you know, the guys in New Mexico, they got all that solar. They got like 500 megawatts of solar, and the guys in Dakota, the Dakota's got like 500 megawatts of wind, and the guys in the southeast, they don't have that. So we got to get them some sun and some wind. And then, of course, he went on to his own personal view of smart grid, which was major transmission across the country. Now, the first reaction is we've got to explain to these individuals that that's not really what smart grid is supposed to be. But my point is, no, don't dissuade them. Let's keep this conversation going. whatever gets us in the door, that's how this town generally works. So I think what I wanted to do is with that fascinating beginning, let me just do a few basics. We all know that, and I should show you a quick visual. In the old world, you had major power sources, usually carbon-based plants, maybe some nukes, entering a huge transmission system, which, of course, is difficult to site, and we're going to get into that, landing at the consumer at the bottom of the page, who is the price taker, and with no options and no thought. And, of course, where we're all trying to get to now is utilities. National Grid is probably the second largest utility in the U.S. now. We're basically focused in the Northeast. We're 50-50 electric and gas, 50-50 here in the U.K. So we're pretty focused on this. And our model, what we're trying to get to, is puts the customer at the top who wants access to all these different alternatives, micro solar, micro wind, geothermal, all these alternatives, whether it's a small business or large business or individual residence. They want that access, and, of course, they want all of it smart. They want it linked, and that's going to require some sort of a smart meter, which is connected to a smart grid. The smart grid, of course, roughly defined, will be one that can self-diagnose. We learned that in the blackout of 2004. It'll be one that can flow power in both directions so that you, of course, can flow power back into the grid. That, of course, is going to be an issue not so much of technology as cost and price in return, because the major utilities obviously have to maintain what is particularly in this part of the world an aging grid. So as they look for a return, they're going to be negotiating with the regulators in terms of how much power comes into the grid, where, under what sort of protocols, and how much, of course, they have to pay for it. Because if we're going to stimulate the microsolar and the renewables that we all want, and we want to stimulate the kind of distributed generation that we want, obviously, that's going to take away from the old world, and we think the sooner we get there, the more we can drive that kind of energy efficiency, which is being discussed up on the Hill today. And for all of you who are in this room, that means you're not at the markup, and I can see now why the room is full. So very quickly, what you're trying to do is you're trying to facilitate all of the technological evolution which is taking place now, which will have smart appliances programmed and thinking about when they operate, real-time pricing, and conservation measures which have been articulated in several different reports, most recently by EPRI, by the McKinsey study. We all know that energy efficiency can be a huge opportunity to reduce demand, to reduce the demand for major carbon-based generation, but to do so, you're going to need that kind of technology, and that technology has got to be in some coherent way some sort of standards across the country, and it's going to require massive investment. Some of the challenges, locations. As I pointed out, there is the opportunity for renewables are dispersed across the country, and there is this vision that all of us can take advantage of local micro technologies. Some utilities are trying to subsidize rooftop solar panels, particularly in our part of the world, where there's an oil burner in the basement. And, you know, that kind of makes sense only after you've got a 96% efficient furnace and you've got your windows that are all Energy Star. So one of the issues that we have on this grid is intermittency. because we have got sometimes over 30% wind on the grid system in parts of Europe, there are real challenges now in terms of how that's balanced. You've noticed recently that there's a new application the Irvings in New Brunswick have put in for a 600-plus megawatt combined cycle gas-fired plant, part of it because they have an LNG port right there, and part of it because they recognize with this great rush to wind and the rush to solar that there's going to be a high requirement of very rapid balancing. And, of course, natural gas combined cycle is a great balancing tool. So you not only have to balance the load because of the intermittency, the sun doesn't always shine, wind doesn't always blow, but you've also got to find a realistic alternative from an emission standpoint as Mr. Waxman and Chairman Waxman and others do their thing. So everything is trying to get us to the same point. We have the luxury of being a regulated utility. So we've just done a filing in New York for both the Syracuse area and the Albany area for about $250 million. It is a legitimate smart grid application. It will include, of course, the kind of technology which will facilitate plug-in hybrids. It facilitates distributed generation, particularly those technologies that I mentioned. And that's what has caught the fascination of the environmental community and of the political community. It's great. There are huge opportunities also in terms of high-volume solar in the desert regions. We have an opportunity in the Northeast in Canada. Hydro-Quebec will be the largest wind power generator in North America by 2015. Their wind load up in the Churchill Falls region, they've counted 10,000 megawatts of wind potential, and they've stopped counting. So it's very difficult to build wind in New York City. The mayor has great aspirations that there will be a wind farm off the Rockaways. We've watched Cape Wind with fascination, and that's not my first choice of words, for 7 or 8 years. Frustration comes to mind. There's Massachusetts. You know, it's the granola crunch guys. It's 15 feet of water. It makes tremendous sense in terms of cost because it's easy to build, and they haven't been able to site offshore wind yet, even off Massachusetts. So the U.S. Northeast, of course, we have a real shortage of renewable energy. We're staring new regulation in the face. We're one of the founding members of REGI. But offshore wind is difficult. Canadian imports are fascinating. But we also have a high-price environment. So when your cost of power, Hydro-Quebec sells their power for 2 cents in Quebec, and we sell ours for close to 20, you'd think there might be a business case for transmission. So, again, that's not technically the definition of smart grid as we filed it in Syracuse, but it sure makes sense in this conversation, and let's not lose that opportunity to talk about all of those things at the same time. So we've got everyone's attention, whether it is large-scale transmission within the country or even internationally to move large-scale renewables. It's accessing and tying in balancing for that interruptible power, and, of course, on the consumer level, get that consumer interest by launching a smart grid program and facilitating these technologies that they've been reading about. I was on the board of AT&T when it came to Canada years ago, and they brought in this great TV commercial of all the things that they could see in the future for your telephone. They pulled it after 2 weeks because everybody was angry because they all came in to buy one. And that futuristic stuff just doesn't work when you don't yet have it on the market. So I think there's a high level of expectation. Look forward to the conversation.
Good morning. I come to you from New York yesterday where I spoke to Moody's Investor Services and some of their clients. And as a joke, I started out and I said, I'm here to bring you stimulus dollars. There were a couple chuckles, and then some hands came out like this. And I was like, oh, okay. These people are really serious about that. I'd like to talk a little bit about the smart grid and a little bit about what David was speaking of, which goes hand in hand, which is electric transmission. Yogi Berra used to say, the future ain't what it used to be. Things are changing, and they're going to change fairly quick. So basically, what's wrong with the grid? In the beginning, all electricity was local. You had your generator, you had a short amount of transmission line that went to your load area, and you had some distribution. Now we have regulation that really opened up, allowed open access. It prompted the acquisition of supplies from non-traditional areas. And the grid as it now exists is not made to achieve the efficiencies that are needed today to get the energy where it is needed. There really hasn't been a significant build-out of transmission since the 1970s, and without the new technology, the current system's really not being maximized. So what will make the grid right? Well, this is the two things I say. First, implementation and application of smart grid technologies and expansion of the current grid. The smart grid will create efficiencies in not only the current grid, but also in an expanded grid. And possibly because of those smart grid technologies, you won't have to build as much electric transmission. So kind of what is the smart grid? I'll kind of give you the commission definition. Smart grid would go something like this. It's the application of new technology to coordinate information from generation sources, demand resources, and distributed energy resources. And FERC, why are they interested at all? Well, we have rate and tariff authority over the utilities that would be utilizing the smart grid or installing smart grid equipment. We have reliability standards that we look at, we approve, and we monitor, and we enforce. And also, it's a desire to support the principles of Title 13 of the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007. Quotes from Chairman and the other three commissioners, I'm not going to read those, but what you look at, several thoughts or themes come together through the quotes. Integrating renewables, controlling costs, interoperability of the grid, reducing emissions, increasing reliability, and deploying, of course, new technologies. Well, FERC is actually doing something. We issued this policy statement, and I don't think I've ever seen it. It was a notice of an action plan, whatever the hell that is. But nothing I've ever seen at FERC. Policy statement and PL-094 kind of setting the rules or wanting to set the rules of the road for the modern grid. And it has four areas it wants to concentrate on to adopt standards for the smart grid. That's cybersecurity, communications between grid participants, making sure all the operators have wide area situational awareness. That's a term of wackiness, but it's you know what's happening in other parts of the interconnection. And also coordinating your operations with new technologies. And also we're going to talk about how utilities can seek to recover those costs through their rates, which is what they would come to FERC for. I have the opinion, a lot of people have the opinion, smart grid is not the cure-all for everything. I support the concepts, but I don't believe smart grid alone will meet our future carbon goals that are set out. A large part of reaching these goals would be by accessing new renewable sources. The administration, it's probably no secret, there's task force out there talking about 10% renewables by 2012. They're talking about 25% renewable energy by 2025. The strangest thing, and what stabs me in the heart is you look at the drafts of energy legislation, they talk about renewable resources, wind, solar, hydro, four paragraphs. Existing hydro is not going to be counted as a renewable. What I would think is the original renewable is not going to be counted. So it's a daunting task to reach those goals. And what I think is if you're for renewables, you better be for electric transmission. And we're going to have more transmission lines to get that renewable power to the load center. But it's not easy to build transmission in the country. My humble opinion, the current siting regime is broken. You have state-by-state regulation of electricity, or at least siting of electricity or electric transmission facilities. And that's well and good. Those people are elected or appointed to be concerned with their state. They really don't care what happens in the next state or the next state over. And as you go back to what I said before, the nature of the electric industry has changed. It's multi-state transmission. It's not within state transmission. The administration, of course, is almost requiring a change in the mix of generation. And my humble proposal is that federal siting of electric transmission will work. We've been doing it for 70 years for natural gas. Admittedly, different kind of physics, but if you adopt the same principles, it will work in this country. And I kind of mentioned what we call our six principles of siting, which we kind of pushed through in the Energy Policy Act of 2005 with regard to gas, and that is you need one lead agency to actually site infrastructure. That lead agency has to coordinate schedules. That is, we're not taking any power away from any siting agency. We're just putting them on a discipline schedule. We need, I don't want to say expedited, but more like coordinated judicial review, if you will. And what that is you build a facility somewhere, someone wants to appeal it where it's going to be built. No go court shopping. Favorite thing among infrastructure opponents. You need one federal record to base your decision on, which is assembled by the lead agency. And probably, I don't want to say most important, but very important, is having the power of eminent domain, a very tricky thing these days. People say, yeah, you have it in gas, and so you just go around and condemn everything in the country. It's not really true. FERC is a pretty good watchdog for the landowners and stakeholders. And just to give you an example, the REX, or Rockies Express Pipeline, which is going to go in full service here in a few weeks, which stretches from the Rockies to eastern Ohio, about 1,800 miles, about 1% of the land there had to go under condemnation proceedings. So eminent domain, while being a hammer, is not a tool that's used often. I just kind of, maybe this is my getcha slides, but just to go back to natural gas, since 2000, we've sited over 10,000 miles of natural gas pipelines that actually cross state borders. Take a look at 345 kV and above during the same period. 682 miles. I don't think that's going to get the renewables where they need to get to, and it's not going to help with the smart grid. That concludes my presentation. I'll be glad to take questions later. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
Lawrence was just commenting on how well this has been teed up for him.
Good morning. First of all, thank you, Frank, and CSIS for inviting me to speak here once again, and David and Jeff, you've set me up. So, and your last slide was pretty interesting. You know, David and I were commenting on the fact that it really puts the smart grid in perspective. I want to spend the next 10 minutes to sort of sum up what's been discussed. And I'd like to do it first of all, at River T&D, just briefly who we are. We develop smart grid technologies and nuclear, and if you need to know more about what we do, you can call me afterwards. So, now, smart grid, what is it? I got a call from my 12-year-old niece a few weeks ago, and she asked me that question. And my 87-year-old aunt, who lives in Philadelphia, called me when her electricity bill went up. And in my family, whenever there's something with the grid, everyone calls me. So that explains it. So she asked, my 87-year-old aunt called me and asked me the very same question. And I was visiting one of our utility clients and talking to a grid operator who's been around for about 35 years in the industry. And he said, Lawrence, what the heck, you guys are talking about smart grid. What's wrong with the grid we have today? Is it dumb? I mean, he's been around for 35 years, and he can count the number of blackouts he's had in his state. But yet and still, we're telling him that, you know, we're going to bring a smart grid. And my presentation, I called it smart grid more than just meters, because there is an aspect of the smart grid that we haven't talked about, which I will touch upon briefly in my remarks, which is the human aspect. And if I ask you what's a smart grid, I would get 100 different answers from each of you. Somehow I would find an intersection of those answers, but basically they would be somewhat different. I did a mini survey in Arriva T&D a few weeks ago when I asked all my colleagues to send me a definition of smart grid. I got 300 emails with all different kinds of definitions of what a smart grid is. And then listening to David and Jeff and you know, being in D.C. and reading all the documents, it's just a plethora of definitions. So what is it? And I will be the first to say I'm not going to define it, because it's not a thing to define. It's my view of it is, before you define a smart grid, you want to start by maybe saying what it is you would like to accomplish. What is wrong with today's grid? My argument is always that today's grid is smart, but not smart enough. Because if it weren't smart, we would be having a lot of blackouts, far more blackouts. In fact, 1965, we had a major blackout, which brought the first generation of, if you may call it, smart grid, because that's when you brought communications into the control room. And seemingly enough, whenever there's a big event in the grid or in the country, the electricity sector takes a step forward. See, as engineers, we've built a very robust infrastructure, which is why you don't have a lot of blackouts. And because of the infrastructure we've built, we've been so dumb enough to build it so good that it takes a long time to change our industry. And in fact, we have to beg, you know, Jeff and others at FERC to do things to sort of move the envelope. But something has happened in the U.S., in the world, that has now made the demand to make what we have as a grid smarter. And if there's anything I want you to take from my talk today, is that not that existing grid is dumb, because if you told an operator at National Grid that he has a dumb grid, trust me, he's not going to give you 1 inch into his control room or into his system to make it smarter. So let's all agree, the grid is not dumb. It's smart, but it could be made smarter. And if we start with the argument, we'll make it much more easier for all of us to understand, because a lot of people are confused today about what this thing is, smart grid. So, can we agree? It's smarter. We all understand what it is now, right? So no more questions. It's a smarter grid. Okay, so let's move on to the presentation. No more questions for us on what a smart grid is. Let's look at the issues of making the grid smarter. So I will jump over the definition, because this is what you always see. And the interesting thing about this slide, it shows you a whole list of things that the smart grid should do. I put my definition in quotation marks because, again, it's not defining a thing. There's a big debate right now in the industry about defining the smart grid so that, from a legal perspective, if you have a common definition, if you go into court to plead a case, at least you know what you're talking about. So the lawyer's going to, you know, try to figure out what a smart grid is, and if they can't come up with a definition, God forbid they're going to create one, and it's going to make our lives difficult as an engineer, because definitions oftentimes put you in the box. I know policymakers, regulators like to have a definition, but from a technologist standpoint, from where we are going, the definition is not the key issue. What is important is, what are the characteristics? I think Frank talked about some of the attributes of what a smart grid is when we talk about it, or a smarter grid. And so these are the attributes, and you see them there. I'm not going to read them. You have the slides. David mentioned a few of them, self-healing. All these are very good concepts. But then when you break it down, what is a self-healing grid? It's a term that means a lot to us, but when you think about it, what is it required to have a grid that is going to self-diagnose itself? Now, a grid starts from the generator all the way down to the consumer. So if you're going to self-diagnose itself, it means that every light in this room should be smarter enough, so that when the frequency drops, when we have a voltage fluctuation, the light bulb should automatically say, I'm going to consume less power. That's a real steep to climb, to have light bulbs that do such a thing. It's not impossible. But if you want to talk about a self-diagnosing grid, that's the gambit of things you're going to have to do from the consumer side all the way up to the generation side. So I think David and Jeff talked about some of the benefits of what a smart grid would do. And I have them listed here. You know, you can start talking about everything from reliability, environmental concerns, energy efficiency, market efficiency. The interesting thing is all of these things can be achieved by a smarter grid, no doubt. But the question is, how do you go about achieving it by making the grid smarter, and where do you make the grid smarter? My title of my talk was Smart Grid More Than Just Meters. And the reason for that is because if we tell the discussion of smart grids to just smart meters, the 765 kV that Jeff talked about and the systems that David talked about would probably never get funded or never get built. because we have defined it in a context that is so limiting that the actual grid, the entire physical grid, is forgotten. And that's one of the issues why defining it, it's not an area I want us to focus on, as opposed to what are the benefits and what it is we're trying to achieve. What can we not do today that we can do better with technology? If we use that as a premise, we can see that all of these objectives and goals can, to some extent, be accomplished. So if you break it down, again, I said from generation all the way to transmission, distribution, and the consumer. So what happens typically in the grid? When you get up in the morning, some utility somewhere has to dispatch power. They have to generate power. When you switch on your light, you get it instantaneously, and you just assume it's there. Well, what is happening is there's a generator that's been dispatched, that's been turned on or turned off to keep the lights running. That energy has to go through a transmission system, which has to do certain things that some of it doesn't do today, which is why you want to make the physical grid even smarter. You want to make the distribution system also smarter. And then you want to make the so-called substation, these things around that you drive by every day, you don't care about, you don't think about. But those are the things that transform the power from one level to another that makes it possible for you to get 120 or 110 in your house. But we don't think about it. So when you're making the grid smart, if you only focus on the meters in your home, what happens to the rest of this side of the grid? And that's where the real challenge comes in, is that do you only want to focus on the meters? What about all this other aspect? And that's where the real struggle is. Deploying meters shouldn't be the real, it's not a difficult thing to deploy meters if you're willing to pay for the meters. But building a new transmission line or modernizing the physical grid, that's where the challenge is. And unfortunately, that is where we have a lot of the policy issues, the policy debate, because it's not easy. And the underlying infrastructure that's there has to do with the architecture and all the software stuff. I'm not going to get into that. But as you can see, you have those four different segments, if you may. And then here again is a summary for each of those sectors. If you come back and ask what's the benefit of a smart grid, you can go into each of those sectors or segments and you will identify benefits that you can accrue from deploying new technology to make each segment of the grid smarter. Okay? So, in summary, energy efficiency and the smart grid, there's something there. And then we have the environmentally friendly aspect. One of the things we don't talk about, the physical assets on the grid, these transmission substations, they use various types of equipment, and they use all kinds of other fuels to keep the system running. Now, SF6 gas is something we have heard about before. We know it has some environmental issues to be resolved, but it's a very huge component of keeping the lights on. How do we replace it? Is it a smart grid deployment to put cleaner transmission substation transformers as opposed to SF6 base transformer? Is it necessary? Well, if your goal is to attack the environmental aspect of the smart grid, then I would argue that a transformer that is not using SF6 gas is a smart transformer. Well, that would not fit to the definition if you use the definition based only on smart meters. So it's a very broad area that we need to cover. And then finally, this issue of workforce, it's one that no one talks about. And my question is, David knows this better than I do. In the utility, more than 30-45% of the utility staff are prepared, eligible to retire. Engineering colleges don't have enough people. So who's going to build this smart grid? Who's going to operate this smart grid? So today we're putting policies in place, we're making investments in technology, but not in people. So how will you have a smart grid without smart people? That's a very interesting question. And then finally, the whole issue of plug-in hybrids that we've talked about, how it's going to change consumer behavior and how that is going to impact the grid. Now, I'll just spend the last few minutes here on something that I'm sure will stimulate a lot of discussion, what I call the cross-cutting issues of interoperability, cybersecurity, and grid reliability. Jeff talked about the FERC policy paper that's out. It's being reviewed. And the issue here with smart grid is because you're putting smart meters in homes that can be aggregated, if FERC sets standards for cybersecurity and interoperability, that crosses into state jurisdiction, how is the policy framework going to be changed? Because now FERC standards will begin to impact in areas that typically are under the jurisdiction of the state. So you have this cross-cutting issue where FERC policies for promoting the smart grid is going to begin to counter or somehow interact or interface with the state jurisdiction over some of these issues. So we're bracing ourselves in an interesting policy argument as it relates to cybersecurity and interoperability, because FERC doesn't have jurisdiction in what happens at a distribution level. But what happens at a distribution level as a result of deploying smart meters could affect what FERC does. And that is an issue I think we should be also discussing. And given the fact that my friends here at CSIS love policy, I thought to leave them with this sort of a policy challenge. You know, how do you reconcile the differences that we see emerging? So, final thoughts, you know, where and to what are we headed? I think we're going to have a smarter grid. The question is when, how fast? And I like this quote from Buzz Halling, which says, the only way to approach such a period in which uncertainty is very large and one cannot predict what the future holds is not to predict, but to experiment and act inventively and exuberantly via diverse adventures in living. So, thank you.
Thank you, Aaron. I'm not disappointed.
Let me start with a couple of questions. One is clearly on investment timing, what needs to be brought to the table to make this happen. But Lawrence, one of your slides, your last slide on substations to consumers, right? We haven't heard a lot of discussion about how we build out from the substation to individual homes. So whether it's plug-in hybrids or the metering that's in your home, it still strikes me that you know, lines that go through tree-lined streets, storms, birds, squirrels, ice, high winds, still have the opportunity to change the system. And then when you look on the cybersecurity side, to the extent that every homeowner now has access to the system, you just increase your security threat by orders of magnitude. But I never hear anything about that piece. So most of the time you hear renewable electricity standards, right, at the front end, production, transmission of ultra-high frequency lines, substation, some technology at the back end, but you never then hear from the substation to the people. So can you just spend a couple minutes on that?
Yeah, well, interesting question. As we speak today, NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, is having their second workshop for cybersecurity, interoperability, and reliability standards. That's part of the EISA bill that gave them $10 million to look at putting these standards in place. I think the real issue why people don't hear about it is that a lot of the focus on smart grid has been for a long time only on the meters, only on the homes, and maybe for logical reasons, because it's easier for a regulator to tell his constituencies, I'm going to give you meters in your home that's going to make your energy consumption reduced it and make your costs less. But the issue of the grid and the substation is going to become even more interesting, because as you deploy these bidirectional meters in homes and you have home appliance networks that have the ability to send signals, the biggest fear that utilities have, and David can jump in here, is that you can imagine, and this is not a good thing to do in D.C., to imagine scenarios that would sort of create chaos, but you can imagine that someone can pretty much program or interfere with your control device at your home that has the ability to send signals, and once it gets on the internet, it's free for all. I mean, even today, you can actually control a power plant from the U.S. if it's located somewhere else in the world via the internet. Now, it's good because, you have people for asset management, but if you think about home appliances, that's the concern that utilities have, and it brings about a very interesting regulatory issue in terms of what standards will control those devices, and how will those standards be set by FERC or by the states. And the FERC policy paper David talked about had probably 150 responses, and they're all about addressing the issue of cybersecurity, interoperability, and who decides, who sets the standards. So That circle of that I showed, my goal is how does the center, the intersection of FERC and the state look like from a regulatory policy standpoint? Maybe David want to jump in.
Good point. We're getting some resistance now in these smart grid discussions to people who don't want to let us into their homes. Mm-hmm. The irony of it is we've been in their homes for 100 years.
But, yeah, exactly.
But, I just don't know.
But just, I mean, we're really there now. A quick anecdote. A friend of mine has an ice cream store, biggest non-franchise ice cream operator in Long Island. He's got just two stores. You can't believe how well they do. He operates the stores in Florida. So he sits down there on his laptop. He's got cameras on the cash desk. He's got cameras outside the store. Some guys are hanging out. He didn't like the look of them. He called the police. He can turn the lights down. He can check the temperature of the freezers. So now he's there often. But, you know, most cash businesses, you always see the owner dragging around saying, oh, I can't go home in this cash business. Well, he operates this whole thing in the virtual world. So it's the technology is there. But you're right. There are people who are very enthusiastic about the opportunity to have the refrigerator talk to the air conditioning unit, and both of them shut down when the dryer's going. That's everybody's vision of a smart grid, is that we're all going to conserve like that. But that is an issue, is that giving us more information, allowing us more opportunities to intrude in one's home or business, we're getting some resistance. And the difficulty is you get that resistance in public discussions.
Yeah.
So now we're back into the regulated world, and, of course, we have millions, and we probably serve 20 million people, but we really have one customer, and, of course, that's the regulator. So the regulator has got to be with the program, and I think that's part of the issue, is that you probably have some patchwork, Frank, across the country in terms of where the regulator is on this issue.
As a regulator, Jeff, do you have a comment?
Nice segue.
I think, and as Lawrence pointed out, there is going to be this intersection of state versus federal. There's going to be this tension that's going to have to be resolved. You do things on the state-regulated level that affect reliability standards. FERC is going to be there. They're going to be in their face. I don't know if this calls for more federal legislation in terms of that, but it probably calls for some kind of understanding. You can't really predict how the legislation would go or what avenue it would take at this time.
All right, I'm Dick Vanatta from the Science and Technology Policy Institute. And the question is, who owns that information? And what are the prospects that that information is going to be put through brokers, put through warehouses, used as information to go back to the consumer and tell them how they should be regulating or how should they be controlling their own energy? What's the public policy on that?
Well, maybe I'm not a policy guy to answer the question, but I think what we're hearing is that the information, like David said, has always been owned by the utilities. They've had it already. Now, what they didn't have was your consumer pattern, because before they pretty much took a sort of an average load profile and people paid flat rates, and so they tend now is to have people respond to signals, right? I think the issue you raise about who owns the data, it's going to be, I think, and he can correct me, I think it's going to be owned by the utility, as they've done in the past. The greater question is, how do you protect the data? I think the ownership issue is one that they can resolve, but the protection of the data is critical. And also, if you get a signal back, if the signal you send to the consumer is wrong, who bears the problem? Whose fault is it? Is it National Grid's fault that you got a signal that was inaccurate? Who bears the problem? I think that's the issue.
Well, that is a good point. But I think in answer to your question, yes, the utility has been garnering this information. Utilities have historically not been particularly good at taking advantage of that information. You know, a few years ago, they started to get into the demographics and analysis and trying to understand the consumer. And, of course, that's everybody's concern, is that the more the credit card companies and others learn about us and that information becomes available, many people are uncomfortable about that kind of profile. Interestingly enough, the utilities are now pretty much, not all, but many are embracing decoupling. So where 3 years ago or 4 years ago, we used to spend a lot of money selling the idea of an outdoor kitchen. You know, everybody had to have, our VP had 9 gas points in his home. He was so proud of the fact that he was burning gas in 9 different places in one residence. Those days are gone. You know, we don't, the marketing department is now in the decoupling mode. We're now trying to sell conservation. We're trying to facilitate high efficiency furnaces. We're trying to reduce the throughput and get incented to do that. So now the big quest is provide us with an incentive to sell less. So I don't know if we've figured out how to best use that information that we're garnering. Historically, the marketing department was starting to sort of gauge patterns and do demographic analysis. So the industry's still in a focus of where are we going in terms of decoupling and where we want to make our investments and how we're going to get cost recovery. One of the things we want to do is get these technologies behind the meter so that you can deploy them. We were testifying before Chairman Markey's committee last year, and Honda was beside me. Got this brilliant free watt unit. Whenever I mention it, people rush to the internet and they want one. You know, it's a little natural gas powered single cylinder generator. Obviously, came off a motorcycle that generates power for the home, and all of the waste heat is captured and goes into a furnace right next to it. And the furnace is manufactured in the U.S. Generator's not. It's not cheap, but it's a wonderful way, and they call it free watt because you're either generating electricity and getting your heat for free, or vice versa. But unfortunately, it's very expensive. Now, it's hugely, the deployment in Japan, it was technology of the year in 2006. Here, you probably have to get those into the rate base in some sort of volume where all of us could share in their cost if we could get them to a point where they become affordable. So in answer to your question, that information could be well used if you're starting to drive the technology changes that people want, but there are huge sensitivities around its release and use.
I'll just throw in here, and I think when you see information and what people would consider to be sensitive information, I think you probably will see some activity on the Hill. People are going to start learning about this, and they're going to start thinking, hey, I don't necessarily want you to know or want you to sell my information to people. So I would expect that to be a flashpoint in the future.
Thanks. Jeff Sciarra, Department of Energy. I wonder if we could return a little bit to the renewable side. And I'm curious if the speakers would have some comments on the tech facts and other technologies available to cope better with the intermittency of renewables and thereby to increase the potential share of renewables on the grid. I'm not talking about the 2,000-mile lines from the windy plains to Chicago or the 2,000-mile lines from the sunny Arizona to Texas. I'm talking about within a given bulk grid, the source of technology improvements that are available to increase the proportion of renewables that could be obtained in a reliable fashion. And would you have a sense of, you know, the percentage share by which such technologies could increase the renewable share? Thanks.
If I could open, I'm sure Jeff will want to speak on this. You know, the utility depends so much on the rate structure, because as I indicated in my remarks, how you price this renewable energy. Bank of America has built an amazing building just off Bryant Park in New York. You probably have read about it. They've taken every possible toy that you can buy and put it into this building. It's got every environmental benefit that one can conceive in an office tower, but the cogeneration units were very expensive and were very costly to put in and have become one of the greatest frustrations. In order to operate, they're selling power back into the grid. In other words, trying to balance them within the building, they just couldn't maximize the benefit. So to get those to run, they're back into the grid. So obviously, a lot of those technologies, it's like community solar, the idea of putting individual solar panels on all these homes, we really should be devoting a tremendous amount of money to community solar, which is flat roofs, schools, public buildings. There's ways to do this which is more cost effective. But the regulator has got to figure out how the utility can still maintain the system and yet accommodate the flow back into the system of that power. And because of its intermittency, and that's my example about the building, is that as long as you can get access into the grid, then there's a great deal of room for renewable energy. But how it's priced, how the regulator allows that cost to be covered, will depend on will drive how it's deployed. Our filing in Syracuse and Albany is terrific. We'll be facilitating that kind of renewable energy and that kind of microsolar and micro wind and whatnot that people can anticipate, and obviously distributed generation and cogeneration in homes and businesses. That's all good stuff, but the beauty of it is it's going to be in the rate base.
I was going to just touch on a point on that, the intermittency, and you hit on a good note. I don't want to call it naivete, but there's a lot of thought out there that, boy, if we just hook up all the renewables, life will be good and the air will be clean. Well, you know, that's not quite right. You hook up renewables, you know, rated capacity, say, of a wind farm, say, of 1,000 megawatts. Well, you can probably divide that by four, and that's what you can reasonably expect on average to get out of a wind farm. What you need to do is you have to have a build-out of renewables over the size of an interconnection, and you can hope that balances it out the loads in different sections, but that's probably not going to do it. What you probably need is more conventional generation. We're talking, a lot of these energy bills are talking about interconnection-wide planning that needs to be done. You're going to have imbalances of renewable load in one area. How do you do it in another area? Doesn't look like we're going to build a whole lot of new coal plants unless we get that carbon capture and sequestration perfected. It's kind of uneconomic right now, and you don't see a lot of investment in that. Nuclear has a long timeline. It's pretty easy to put gas fired generation to balance your renewable load. Takes up a small footprint and is about a 50% cut in emissions from coal.
If I may, to answer his question, let me just go to my... I just want to say something. Because he used an acronym that I'm not sure everyone is familiar with. You said FACTS, and let me just... I had it on my slide on efficiency, and maybe this would... So FACTS. The question was, what's the role of FACTS? And so FACTS stands for Flexible AC Transmission System. And the question is, what are these? So one of the issues with renewable is, of course, that most of the renewable we have today consume a lot of reactive power. The grid needs reactive power. And if you ask what reactive power is, who all drink beer in this room? Let's see the hands of those who drink beer. Okay, so if you're a drinker of beer, you realize that when you pour the beer uncontrolled, you end up having a foam, right? Well, that foam is beer, but it's useless beer. Think of reactive power as the foam that you get when you sort of a unorganized or uncontrolled send power off the grid because of losses. So reactive power support is a key issue for renewable. It's a key issue for keeping the grid stable. Now, your issue of the percentage, today we know that if you can deploy FACTS devices across the grid, you can have significant opportunities to bring a lot of renewables online, because what FACTS does, it allows you to deal with the intermittency, not in terms of generation being pumped in, but in terms of dealing with the voltage fluctuation that the intermittency brings about. The other issue about, you know, talking about energy FACTS, the new kind of FACTS I envision is energy storage, which is something we probably can talk about later, but energy storage can also help to tackle the issue of renewables. So that's what FACTS is. And again, another takeout from you, and the next time you drink beer, remember FACTS, remember smart grid. So there's a good connection right there.
And useless beer.
Useless beer, exactly.
One of the follow-ups to that, though, so if on the balancing side, you know, people talk about a renewable electricity standard, for a system load, is there a generic 17%, 20%, or is that a myth as well?
You say 17, 20%.
Well, the amount of renewable power that you could put on the system without having extra intermittency backup, natural gas for base load and peak. You know, that you just can't have a system that's 90% renewable unless you have storage.
Well, I think Lawrence would probably be better. I'm not an engineer, and I don't pretend to be.
Yes. I like when a policymaker says that. Anyway, I'm just kidding. But the point here is very interesting because, and I've had this discussion with Frank before regarding renewable and the percentages. I think wind forecasting is helping to address this issue of how much renewable you can bring online. And so as better forecasting tools are brought to the market, we see that the concerns about the intermittency is going away because you can predict much better today how the wind profile is going to flow. And again, another interesting policy question is how do you put in place regulatory frameworks that will not penalize wind because of the intermittency? And one way is to use better wind forecasting tools. Yeah.
But I think that is a very good
question, Frank, and what they're finding in Germany, and I don't know that this is published, but in my conversations, some of their wind farms are 35% of the base load. And, of course, we don't talk much about renewables as being a capacity play or base load. We really talk about it as an energy source for the reasons that Lawrence just mentioned. And where they've gone to 33-34%, we're hearing that they're encountering real difficulties and that they're relying heavily on nuclear power from France, and they're purchasing a lot of power. And where we sometimes think that you could have 35 or 40% of your power from renewables, we're, of course, you know, we're taking baby steps relative to what they're doing. But that's probably where you start to crash and burn. But it raises another point, coming back to Jeff's world. Jeff knows that I've been through 7 and 8 year projects trying to just land gas pipelines that have been approved by his team because of state intervention. The piece that I think we're missing, Frank, is natural gas, because as we talk about energy efficiency, and natural gas gets captured in this energy efficiency, let's lower the amount of natural gas. It'll be so key, I think, to advancing a smart grid, my own perspective, that we have to be careful here. The NRDC, and we work closely with them, and they're as you know, they're very public. The Natural Resources Defense Council gets a tremendous amount of press in this area. I've also lived for years trying to enhance or expand natural gas vehicles. They're not with me on the natural gas vehicles. They are, however, very supportive of combined cycle baseload generation gas fire. They think that we should be electrifying the transportation sector. They think that we should reduce the number of vehicle miles traveled. The VMT should come down. But they love the idea of electrification, and they love natural gas combined cycle. And, of course, for the NRDC to support a carbon plant, the first one they supported was the plant we built in New York in 2004. They cut the ribbon. They'd never done that before. So I think that's kind of where things are moving, is that we have a tremendous balancing challenge ahead of us. So we've got to make sure that we don't, in this great rush to renewables and this administration and this Congress, lose the opportunity for relatively clean carbon power.
My name is Jack Liebowitz, a retired NIH scientist. Germany has introduced the feed-in tariffs to promote their renewables. I understand that that's probably difficult because of the different regulations in different states. But I wonder if there could be since we would have siting, federal siting, maybe we could have uniform regulations and approach it, the feed-in approach that Germany is using.
I see nothing wrong with that. I mean, it makes sense. There's a lot of common sense. These things need to be transmitted also to Capitol Hill as well, so that they understand. I mean, it's a real learning process up there when they do and they tackle energy legislation. And they talk to us. They talk to the Department of Energy. They talk to a lot of different agencies and try to learn. You know, it's down to the basics also of what's the right renewable standard. I mean, we're going to have 50 different renewable standards. It's kind of silly. And that's why you're seeing, and I think that's today's markup is on renewable standards in the Bingaman bill. But as you're saying, other technological aspects, they need to understand that to actually make the system and make it a go, make it work.
And you captured a very good point, which in this country, price, not that price is everything, price is just such a huge driver. I mean, very frustrating for us. A year ago, people were paying $5,000 above list for a Prius. And now, of course, Prius has dropped their price down to $22,000 to compete with the Honda, and there's a 146-day supply of Priuses sitting on the lot. My next-door neighbor just sold his townhouse at a loss. He'd been there about a year, but he also sold his Cadillac Escalade. Now, the Escalade was 3 years old, it had 14,000 miles, and it was mint condition. He sold it to trade it in for a Blue Tech diesel, but he lost more money on his SUV than he lost on his home. So traded in for $14,000, paid $68,000 for it, and that's kind of where the world is going at the moment, or where it was going 4 or 5 months ago. And now that the price of oil came back down, bang, people's purchasing habits are shifting again. So my point of this is that you have to make this renewable power affordable in a way so that people are not forced to make those buying decisions if you want to expand the base.
Could have sold his house and lived in the Zest Park.
Hi, Dana Zerskind from the George Washington University. Actually, I have a couple of questions, but the first thing that I want to ask, do you think that smart metering at the end is going to reduce the consumption of the electricity of individual customers or just going to shift their time of usage of energy? So it will just reduce the peak loads. And another one, when you talk about the, you know, smart dispatch, and if you're looking U.S., you're actually looking at billions of optimization points. And because of the remote locations of the renewable, and by the way, I want to just say that wind and solar are not intermittent, they're variable. So if you have a good forecast, you actually know what's going to happen 3 or 5 hours later. So when you're looking at the, you know, U.S. as a whole, and when you're looking at the smart dispatch, you're actually looking to a very big area and very, you know, long execution optimization times. And when you look at the, you know, current power of the coal or nuclear power plants, when you have increased wind speed, you have to get that wind power into the, you know, grid. So the coal producers or the nuclear power plants has to reduce their production in order to get that electricity into the grid. Do you think that there's going to be a resistance from those coal and nuclear owners because, you know, they're going to be losing some sort of income that they're going to have? And do you think that because they're going to be selling less because of all these renewable resources, they're going to charge more, so at the end we're going to see a significant increase in the electricity price in the U.S.? That's it. Thank
you. Well, the first question about whether we'll see the whole energy conservation issue, it depends on the price signal. We know that we're going to have rate caps removed in parts of the U.S., and my argument has always been, and this is just my personal opinion, not that of a reaver, is that if people were exposed to the true cost of electricity, maybe they would react. It's an issue here of how do you sort of show people the actual price, and that means price where you have no price caps like you have in some states. If that happens, it might help. I think we're on an experimentation phase here as it relates to smart meters and the benefits it's going to have, because we're not, you know, you're deploying, what, 11 million smart meters in PG&E in California. It will take a few years before you see the benefit of that. So, you know, again, it's all based on how humans are going to respond. And like I said, my 87-year-old aunt doesn't really care about anything that's smart around her. She just, in fact, she's very smart herself, so she knows when to turn off her lights and turn it on. So, again, it's hard to say. I think we'll see after a couple of years whether it paid off with regards to this. The last issue about smart dispatch, that's a regional issue in terms of how the U.S. is structured. If you go to the West Coast where you have a lot of renewable, a lot of hydro, you may have a whole different kind of construct for smart dispatch. If you go in the Southeast where you may have a lot of coal, you have a different construct for how smart dispatch is going to work. I think at the end of the day, if you have markets in place, it may help solve the problem. Otherwise, you know, I think the optimization issue you raise is not really a big challenge today. You can, you know, I always say if you can put a man on the moon, you can pretty much solve a lot of these problems. Well, yeah, but again, it all depends what do we want as a society. If we put a price tag on environment and 25, 35, 40 years from now, and we believe in a clean environment for the next generation, maybe it's okay for us to increase price. I mean, that's what the Europeans do. That's what the Swedes do. I mean, in Sweden, when you increase taxes for, ironically, for environment, there's less reaction than if you increase taxes for other things because they just value the environment. So maybe it's a value change we'll see in the U.S., and maybe people would love to pay higher taxes for a cleaner environment.
Or not. If I could just respond, I naively think I've been wearing this peace ring longer than you've been around. But you know, I hope that when people become aware of the true cost of energy, mm-hmm. I think they will make those kinds of decisions because people don't want to be suckers. I mean, you're not seeing a lot of people buying a new Bentley today in this economy, mm-hmm. and driving down the street with the window down, you know, being noticed. I do think that there's been a bit of a shift. Is it a seismic shift? Maybe it is. I'm not sure. But you raised the issue of the generators and charging more and whether they'll really embrace renewables. And it is an interesting question as we got to some real numbers. I mean, clearly, the generators are sitting there with such a small percentage of generation within North America is coming from renewables. But I do think that it's going to be driven by the consumer. And part of the difficulty that we have now is that a lot of consumers have very affordable power because of their fuel choice. Mm-hmm. And that's not just in the South. It's throughout the U.S. If we shut down all of the generation within the New York region, for instance, we would still be out of compliance because the emissions from the Ohio Valley takes 24 hours to get to the East Coast. And so they've been able to build an industrial base. They've got very low-cost energy. There's not a lot of conservation going on in some of those regions. And that's when, of course, it becomes more regional. So, you know, my fervent hope is that where those regions engage and we drive these technologies and smart grid does kick in and people show an enthusiasm for this and they lower their consumption of energy, which I think many will want to do, I think then it will continue to grow because I do think it becomes an issue of competitiveness. We're in a little hiatus right now in energy prices. We're not so naive to think that this isn't going to blow again. I think there are some Republican strategists that are watching all of the energy focus right now, which they normally would be a part of, and some of them are quietly thinking, well, you know, the price of energy is going to be so much higher 2 years from now. Let's make sure that we put the blame where it belongs. I'm not speaking for any party. I'm just saying that this is some of the dynamic out there. We're in a hiatus in terms of energy price, and it's going to go up. And I think when it goes up, shame on us if we haven't made some effort now to reduce our consumption because there's no other real way to keep energy prices down.
Just wanted to go back to your first point about are we going to get large tangible gains from the individual, from the household. I think with the smart grid, you're going to get the lion's share of your gains or your efficiencies or your savings upstream of the meter, so to speak. I think it's going to be a lot of personal choices, and like David said, hopefully there'll be, you know, mindset changes, if you will. People will want to conserve. But I think, we've talked this out, I think the acid test is if I'm going to see the price of energy when it's 95 degrees and 80% humidity out there, am I going to turn the AC off? No, I don't think so. I mean, I've got a programmable thermostat. It's great, you know. It goes up, down, turns off when I leave the house. And that's good stuff. I've got a solar-powered attic fan. But I don't think I'm going to go that much further. I mean, I don't want to sit at my desk and program my refrigerator or tell the washing machine to start because prices are low all of a sudden. So incremental gains in the household and maybe building over time.
We'll take two questions. Good throw back here and then right up front, and then I'll come around.
Question for all four of you, including the moderator. My name is Glenn Schlady, and I'm just an ordinary taxpayer, citizen, consumer. You've mentioned cybersecurity several times, but I have a question about physical security. You seem to be talking about expanding long-range transmission, 765 kV lines increase. That seems to fit in well with the desires of most people in urban areas to get their electric generation as far away from it as possible and fits in with the renewable push. But I don't have any experience as a terrorist, but it seemed to me that a few terrorists with relatively unsophisticated weapons could knock out a whole lot of this transmission and leave major metropolitan areas without electricity for at least hours and perhaps days. What is it that you have in mind for that problem?
Well, if I can open, there are certainly local rules. There's New York, for instance. Most of the power within New York City has to be generated from within New York. So that's been around since the early blackout days. I don't think they anticipated any kind of overt acts. It was all just based on reliability. And I think the reliability standards that we have in place will manage much of that. It's never a perfect solution, but I would defer to my friends.
Physical security, that's tough. You've got, 160,000, 170,000 circuit miles of transmission now in the country. You got 210,000 miles of interstate pipeline, 80,000 miles of intrastate pipeline. It really, you can't protect it on a daily basis in terms of having people out in the field. I have a lot of contact with Mexican regulators, and they had some terrorist activities. They blew up pipeline down there last year. And what they were able to do, because they only have X thousand amount miles of pipeline and 4,000 to 5,000 miles, is they deployed the army at periodic places. That kind of physical presence can work in a system like that. It just cannot work here. You're going to have some kind of trust, some kind of faith, and corny as it sounds, it's kind of the price of democracy.
Well, I think one of the things that we see happening is that sensors with cameras can be placed at physical equipment to protect them. Now, if we wanted to do a real interesting smart grid project, we would put micro sensors or micro cameras on every single transmission tower in the country. It would be, you wouldn't need 20 million meters to do that, but you can do it. I mean, you can, and you can feed that information in real time into the control center. A lot of utilities are doing it today, although not on a wide scale. So I think from a physical protection, thank you for the idea, actually. It's a good one where you can imagine a smart grid project where you simply put, you know, smart cameras on every single transmission tower to monitor it. At least you will know what's going on there. And the monitoring can be a sensor where if you come within a certain perimeter of the transmission tower or the transmission line, you can send a signal to, you know, Homeland Security or wherever that there is a trespassing. Today, you don't have that level of sophistication. So, good idea.
Well, remember, that comes at a cost.
Oh, yeah, but no, but cost is not an issue right now, Jeff, right? You just said you were giving money in Wall Street, so.
Yeah.
Let me just add, I share your security. It just strikes me that complex systems lead to complex problems.
Yep.
This idea of community solar and some move to distributed energy is intriguing. And the fact that we ought to pilot some of this stuff, whether it's on military bases or college campuses, there's ways of doing this before we go to wide-scale application. Go ahead, please.
I'm Bill Holmberg at Biomass Coordinating Council, and my feelings are hurt. Nobody mentioned biomass. About half of the renewable energy, half of the renewable energy comes from biomass. You mentioned wind and solar and hydro and geothermal, but no biomass.
Well, I apologize because I actually live in New York, which probably has the highest tipping fees, certainly on the continent. And we have some not in New York City. There are some combustion plants, as you know, some trash burners. Covanta has plants on Long Island and around. But we don't have digestion, and we're talking to environmental groups, including NRDC, to try and correct that. We were the first company to capture methane off a landfill site in Staten Island. And there's a famous story of Mayor Koch went out there and was barbecuing hot dogs for the press. And they didn't know there was a propane tank hidden under the truck, but they thought that this was coming up out of the dump. So you had all the gulls and the smell. And, of course, there was Koch in front of the cameras trying to feed them hot dogs. So that's been operating right into our system with very little cleanup for years. So, yes, it's an active industry now. It has tremendous potential going forward. It's startling to me that we haven't made more progress.
Let me also apologize and briefly say that Areva has a partnership with Duke, and we're building 10 biomass plants around the country. But I didn't bring it up because I just took for granted that everybody would agree that biomass is the thing, so I apologize.
And it is listed in the potential bills
exactly
as a renewable.
Yasser Elshimi, Center for New American Security. I was wondering if legislation is indeed available, how long are we looking, in terms of the time frame, how long is it going to take to actually build a truly smart grid? And how does that fit with President Obama's carbon reduction, carbon emission reduction targets?
Excellent question.
Our focus is right now is to capture the thought that we need to stimulate the economy. We think that expenditures on smart grid will have a much longer-term benefit to the economy of the country than other ways to deploy stimulus dollars. Number two, there's a fascination right now within the community, within the country, probably because of our concerns about international security issues and because of our concerns about our foreign dependence on oil and the high cost of last year. So we're trying to catch the wave. I think Frank makes some very good point. Let's get a couple of pilots out there to demonstrate some of this before we start to preclude other solutions because of our enthusiasm for, quote, smart grid, which is not well understood. In terms of the timing, that's a very, very difficult question because it depends entirely on the resources. And I think, as Lawrence mentioned, the average age of a utility employee right now is very close to 50. So we have a very real issue in terms of skill sets and the ability to build this system out. But it's a whole different industry. It's an entirely new industry, and that's why it's caught the attention of this town.
The only point I would just add there regarding the timing is it depends on what you define as a smart grid. You said the ultimate smart grid. Well, one thing we haven't talked about today is superconducting materials. We haven't talked about nanomaterials. Those are things that can make the electric grid, the physical grid, even more smarter. So much more smarter. So I think in terms of the achievement of the administration's goal, you know, again, some things will be achieved, but I won't put no timeline as to when we can have it because I don't think we can ever have that completely smart grid that does everything. It's just, you know, because you can always add it and make it smarter. 10 years from now, we'll be talking about a smarter grid and a smarter grid because you just keep, you know, making it smarter and smarter. So I wouldn't want to focus on a time frame.
Bill Magwitterman with Advanced Energy Strategies. Actually a follow-up question to the last question, and a really simple one, which is we've heard about the idea of a renewable portfolio standard of 25% by 2025, which is about 15 years from now, which in utility terms is no time at all. What does that mean for the grid in physical terms? What do we have to do to get to 25%? How much is that going to cost? And just generally, what's your opinion about how that's going to get paid for?
Last time I looked, there's only two pots. There's the consumer and there's the taxpayer, and so many of them are in common. And you're right. There's only two pots to draw on to do this, candidly. There will be investment dollars, but those investment dollars are scarce at the moment. The ability to attract capital. I mean, the Wall Street Journal was saying that people are issuing bonds. Isn't life great? And I'm just not seeing it. I don't understand how there can be such enthusiasm for economic recovery when we still seem to be kind of in the glue. So one of the issues is that we can still borrow money. We're a very large corporation. There's a huge lack of capital, which I think plays into that goal. That said, we embrace that goal, of course, because we want to see the right decisions made to start to deploy. But we come back to we can't physically get to those numbers without major transmission. I, too, struggle with the definition and the way hydro is treated. I think new generation within existing hydro, I think, is covered. There is an opportunity there. But New York State, as you know, draws on Niagara Falls. It's a huge amount of power for one of the states that we serve. So in answer to your question, there's only two pots, not cheap, but we have to do it because the alternative is less appealing.
Go ahead.
I think also on another bent, on legislative bent, what you see, you're not only seeing federal siting, you're seeing an emphasis on planning. And we're not talking about five-year plans or whatever. They're talking about interconnection-wide plans that are going to be mandated. In other words, how are we going to integrate, say, renewables? How are we going to get this on the grid within a certain amount of time? And in addition to that, they're dealing with cost allocation, which is always kind of the big bear, if you will, and trying to figure out who's going to pay for it and whether it should be allocated to those people that FERC can decide benefit from it most, or are we going to get expanded authority to allocate cost over the, say, interconnection-wide for the benefit of the country?
I think the issue of cost recovery, I know FERC in their new policy has this interim cost recovery for smart grid technology for smart technologies. You know, the issue of facts, the general asked the question about facts. There is technology today that can be deployed. The problem is, in some instances, those technologies are not considered transmission-centric, even though they help the grid. So you have to change the definition of what is transmission. Because I think if you deploy more fax devices, more HVDC, medium voltage HVDC, you could help to bring more renewables to the market. But those things are just not defined as transmission today in some jurisdiction. And so I think that would help to bring more of those renewable online. For the whole U.S.? Well, it depends on whether, I mean, I would say, and this is not an official number, I would just guess that if you were to try to focus on just a fax HVDC, you're talking probably about maybe $5 billion, perhaps.
And it's a net cost, too.
Yeah.
We also, it's going to be driven in part by the cost of carbon energy. We have to remember that it's impossible to nail that number because there's just too many variables in that equation. But we just recently bid on a very small job, a restaurant, where the person's on propane. It's going to cost him $30,000 to put his line in, and we were able to get it down to $20,000 for various different ways. But it's going to save him $6,000 natural gas versus propane just in his offering. This is a summer restaurant on the bay kind of thing. Just to give you, there's a visual. So many people in the Northeast use propane because they can't get natural gas. Its system is not built out. And propane, of course, is manufactured from oil, and natural gas is natural gas domestically provided. That just shows you that there's a... Now, you start putting that shift into, you know, bunker oil, and as you start to price in carbon, now you really got a conversation.
Let me just move kind of from the utopian to the mundane a little bit. We talked about rate structure and cost recovery, and David, you had mentioned this too. So in the past, it's been that utilities make money by selling more. So it has to be a mind shift about how you sell less and incentivize people to use less and still allow for recovery. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what needs to happen from the regulatory side and the policy side to bring that home? Let's start.
Well, I think you've seen some separation between selling units and basing. So that separation where we're going to provide a service and we're going to get a return on it. Instead of we're going to sell, we expect to sell so many units and get a return on that. You need to separate kind of the flow from the income. And I'm not being real articulate, but I know David probably is.
Well, we live this file because, of course, for years we have been compensated by how much gas we move. We've never owned the gas since deregulation. In the old days, the utility might actually buy the gas and resell it. But the model for the last number of years is we're just Federal Express. We just deliver it. But we earn a return on the volume or the number of molecules of gas going through the pipe, the number of electrons going across the wire. So the more we sell, the more we make. Now we've decoupled. We haven't fully decoupled, but every time we get a rate case, we are asking for decoupling, where you get like a flat rate per consumer, so that we don't benefit from any increase in the consumption per consumer. Still allows us to add consumers, build out our systems, we back out oil and put in natural gas, so we can still expand our system and make more money that way. We can't make more money by selling more gas to an individual customer. That's decoupling. It was tried a few years ago, didn't work because some people, their rates went up, because the base cost, the flat rate just to have gas service, turned out to be slightly more expensive than some people who were on cooking only. So all of a sudden, people, their rates went up, and it was a bit of a kerfuffle. But now, that's the new world that most utilities are applying to decouple, so that there's no incentive to try and sell more. And in fact, if you do it right with the regulator, utilities will move with a tiny incentive. You just give us a fraction of a point to change our behavior, and we will change our behavior because we're just so big. We have like 9 million meters. So if we make a little tiny bit more for that meter to run less, then we're going to do that. And in our company, 10% of our incentive comp, the officer's incentive comp, 10% is tied to carbon budgets. So we have all sorts of budgets for everything else that we do, and we introduced this year that our carbon budget has to go down, and that is in fact tied to our incentive comp. So that's kind of how far it's gone with us.
The point I want to raise then is that I talked about the beer, the foam. Well, reactive power is one thing, Frank, that hasn't been priced. And if we really want to address one of the issues from the grid reliability standpoint, maybe there needs to be a policy that addresses who pays for reactive power and how do you price reactive power. Because today we're all benefiting from it, but no one is really pricing reactive power. And I believe that there is a market. There should be something done from a policy standpoint. It's not easy. We haven't talked about the transmission losses, and that's where it comes into play, the amount of transmission losses. You talk about savings. If you could reduce the transmission losses by even 30-40%, that's more than you would achieve in some of the smart metering energy efficiency program. So invest in the grid, make the grid more efficient, and you have huge energy savings, and put a price on reactive power.
Well, it's clear that we just scratched the surface here. We're going to have more sessions on this. We want to explore this idea of what you do in a carbon control session. Thank you all for coming.